75% of Americans believe in UFOs. 30% of Americans believe UFOs are vehicles from other worlds. And 3% of Americans believe they have been abducted by aliens. That's over 8 million people. They're out there, aren't they?
Welcome to the UFO Files Show with your host, Jerry Pippin.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to our show, Conspiracies, UFOs, the paranormal. We've got it all here tonight, and we're broadcasting live here at 7 o'clock Eastern, 5 o'clock Mountain, 4 o'clock Pacific, and of course, Nick Redfern, our first guest, is like me in the Central Time Zone. I believe he's still there. We'll find out. He moves around a lot, and you'll understand why when we talk about this latest book. Boy, It's really full of revealing lots of secrets and things that some of us knew a little bit about, but not as much as Nick Redfern has uncovered. And I think you'll find the show fascinating. I talked to Larry Dickin, who used to help me with the show and produce a show for a long time, I think 7 or 8 years. And it's been about 7 or 8 years since we've done that. He's still doing well in Secaucus, New Jersey. We talk every once in a while. We're going to have to bring Larry back home for another show one of these days. We'll do that. We do have some shows lined up coming up. I might like to mention before we bring on Nick, on March 3rd, we will have Jim Mars. And Jim is going to talk about the super elite and how they're running the world, whether we know it or not. And he's got a few connections there, paranormal, UFO connections, and a few other things. That's our good friend Jim Mars. And that will be coming up on March 3rd. Then on March 10th, we have Paula. Before I even bring on Paula's completely to give her a plug, I wanted to mention that I got something plugged about her the other day. She's evidently getting ready to do another festival. She's always doing those festivals. And so if she's not promoting them, she's involved in them. And of course, she's one of the better people around when it comes to talking about UFOs and exopolitics and things of that nature. And it's interesting when we talk about some of the things that are happening here, that none of it would happen without the help of the Inception Radio Network. And not only do we have Joe Champion, who's directing the show tonight and producing it, but in addition to that, the other board of director members are Mike Lucas. And a lot of people know Mike as MJ, and then Bob Tarnack. And without those three, the Inception Radio Network, nor the Jerry Pippin Show, as far as that goes, would never make it. Now, when we talk about Nick Reed, his latest book, I love the title. It's called For Nobody's Eyes Only. And he's standing by. We'll bring you on in just a minute. But I wanted to mention before we get to the end of the show that on June 13th and June 14th, we'll be broadcasting the Border Zone Conference live, gavel to gavel. Each speaker, it'll all be free of charge from Edinburgh, Texas. And you can hear it all right here on the Jerry Pippin Show and on the Inception Radio Network. That's June 13th and June 14th. Nick Redfern, I think I made you wait long enough for your introduction. Welcome to the show. It's always great talking with you.
Well, thanks for having me on again, Jerry. It's been quite a time, I think, since I was last on your show, if I remember right.
Well, no, we've had you on as many times as we can. I've been battling a few illnesses, which you may or may not know. In fact, I'm broadcasting tonight from a medical facility, not back at home yet, and I have beaten cancer and a couple of things we're working on, and I think I'll probably be out and around as good as new by the middle of April. At least that's what my doctor told me the other day, and he's not really an optimistic guy, so it was great news to hear that. Yeah, that's really great. Yeah, you know, when we talk about the things that are happening in this new book, I thought some of the pretty interesting things there that you had included, and we have to mention that, first of all, is Roswell. As you know, you and I go to Roswell quite a lot. You've been there with several different theories, and now you've got something new going on. So what have you found out about Roswell this time?
Well, yeah, I mean, Roswell certainly is without doubt the most sort of famous UFO case of all time. But on top of that, it's also, excuse me, potentially the most important case as well in terms of, you know, where it could sort of lead and open doors in terms of the UFO community. And the new book, For Nobody's Eyes Only, is a study of how and under what circumstances official files on a wide range of different mysteries have simply vanished, you know, literally into nowhere. We just cannot find them. And certainly Roswell is a perfect example of that. And I point out a number of examples where official files on the Roswell case should exist in some capacity, but they cannot be found anywhere at all. Now, one classic example that I talk about in the book goes back to the early 1990s when the then congressman for New Mexico, Stephen Schiff, lobbied the General Accounting Office, as it was called back then, but today it's called the Government Accountability Office, to look into Roswell. And the GAO is a very sort of powerful organization that can go knocking on the doors of pretty much every agency of government and say, hey, you know, we want to see this or we want to see that. And what was interesting is that when various checks were done for files that might exist from the 1947 period as they related to the activities of the old Roswell Army Air Force base in Roswell, what was interesting wasn't so much what was found, but what wasn't found. And literally all of the outgoing messages from the base from 45 to 49 and a bunch of other documents leading through to 1950 have literally vanished. They cannot be found anywhere. And
are you saying from 47 to 1960?
No, from 45 to 50.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, from 45 to 50.
That's even more, about 2 years before the Roswell crash.
Yeah, and I mean, and a number of questions have been asked, of course, as to how and why the files are gone. Now, different theories have been put forward that, you know, if the files were related to the Roswell event, and it kind of seems a bit suspicious if they weren't, what other reason would it be? Why were files from 45 pulled when the event occurred in 47? Well, one possibility is that perhaps whoever pulled the files, and who knows when it was, it could have been decades ago, they may well have just been protecting all bases and, you know, covering everything to ensure nothing got sort of put in a previous file by mistake. So in other words, they could have been just sort of covering their own backs to make sure nothing got left behind. Now, what's interesting in this theory, you know, a lot of conspiracy theorists point the finger at the government or the Air Force as the bad guys, but they forget it was actually the Air Force who brought it to our attention via the General Accounting Office that the files were gone. So my view is I don't think at all that the government, the regular government or the Air Force are the bad guys in terms of these files going missing. What I personally think is that there's like almost like an unacknowledged shadow government or shadow agency that oversees the UFO phenomenon, which is pretty much answerable to no one, which operates on kind of like a black budget situation, and which essentially follows its own agenda, and there's no oversight. And so I actually don't think at all that the Air Force played any sort of role in terms of making this material go away or vanish any more than I think the Pentagon or the White House did. I think these people are actually out the loop, even though many people assume that they're inside the loop. But regardless of what happened to the files, they vanished. You know, that is a fact. All those outgoing files from Roswell from 45 to 50 are gone, and there's no actual official explanation as to how or why they were destroyed or pulled or on whose order even. So that itself is even more of a mystery.
This kind of, tweaks my mind into high gear, and I think immediately of MJ-12 and supposedly rumored secret agencies running things. And I don't know if you found anything about MJ-12, but I guess you did find something about there was a secret agency.
Yeah, I mean, you know, whether it's a group called MJ-12 or what it's called, I think the one thing we can all agree on when it comes to Roswell is that somebody is hiding the secret. But when, say, for example, the General Accounting Office went looking, and even the Air Force were the ones who said, hey, you know, we've gone looking, but we haven't found any files, but we have found a massive amount of files missing, you know, this demonstrates to me that even the people who we think should know don't know. So, again, I think this is a good pointer towards the idea that whatever happened, somebody is sitting on the truth of Roswell. But, you know, I think the big irony is that there could well be people sort of sitting in the Pentagon tonight saying to each other, I wonder what happened at Roswell. You know, we expect those people to know, but I don't think they do. I don't think the government or the Air Force, as I said, are the bad guys. And I don't think any elected body of government or any known official agency of government or military or the intelligence community, I don't think they're the bad guys. I think we don't even know who the people who are hiding the truth of Roswell really are, because they're buried so deeply and unofficially, you know, they don't exist, or even officially they don't exist. You know, they kind of exist in some sort of limbo of secrecy that even in government, unless you have the key, you know, you just don't gain access to it.
How many people do you think were in this group that put the lid on everything, and so not even the Air Force knew what was happening?
Do you think it was 12 people
or 100 or?
Well, I mean, it's going to be any sort of figure is going to be like a hypothetical one, but I think what I would say is that if the secret's been so well kept for so long, and if you think about it, we haven't really had that many leaks about Roswell. What we've had are people who've come forward to say, hey, I was at the base at the time, but we haven't really, you know, had many people say, I work on this project today and this is what's going on. You know, just a few. So I think that the number of people who know, you know, we assume that a project like Roswell, that there would have been thousands and thousands of people assigned to it. Well, it could be the exact opposite, ironically, that to keep the secret, you keep the numbers down. And that might also mean that if you keep the numbers down, you actually don't make that much progress in trying to figure out how the technology works. You know, we assume that the finest minds on the planet would be investigating it all. But if there's a fear that having too many people on board would cause, you know, a leak here or a leak there, then it might actually just be a small number of people who are in the know, you know, sort of an overseeing group of 20 or 30 and perhaps a couple of hundred scientists and that's it, you know. I think it could well work like that. We imagine sort of some huge agency, the equivalent of like the CIA. It might not, and I think it's likely to be a smaller group purely from trying to prevent, you know, any sort of untoward leaks or whatever.
And it's pretty obvious, I think, to most of us, that there were secrets kept. What's the big deal after 50 years? I mean, why are the secrets kept? It sounds to me like you're saying, well, maybe they just don't know anymore. They lost everything.
Well, excuse me. I don't think it's so much the case that the people who are covering up the truth about Roswell have lost the information. But I do believe the elected governments, and I do believe today's Air Force, don't know anything about Roswell. You know, a lot of people say, oh, the evil Air Force, you know, the Air Force are hiding the truth of Roswell. I really don't believe that. I think that today's Air Force are as baffled as we are as to what happened 67 years ago. You know, that's a long, if you think about it, that's a long time. It's almost 70 years ago when the event happened, which is plenty of time for whoever's hiding the truth to even keep it out of the hands of today's official agencies like the Air Force or the Army or the CIA, and to keep it in the hands of this small group. So yes, I do agree with you in the sense that the people who we think should know don't know the truth, and they have, by, for all intents and purposes, lost the information or it's been taken. But who is sitting on it? That's the big question. And until we sort of know the answer to that, there's no way for us even to really know where to go looking. You know?
It's always fascinating, at least to me, about Roswell when we talk about it, is the government evidently admits something's going on, then they deny it, and people buy the denial more than the original story for some reason. Many people, at least. However, I think a lot of people believe that Roswell occurred with UFOs, ETs, extraterrestrials, and others believe, and you've done stories about this, that it was some sort of secret project that was mistaken for ETs. After all those years, Nick, have you come up on a pet theory by now, a hypothesis of what really happened to Roswell?
Well, for me, I still think Roswell could go one of two ways, and only one of two ways. I don't, you know, if you look at the weather balloon theory and the crash test dummies, they kind of fall apart as well. And what's more important, as I note in the book, the official files that presumably should exist on the weather balloon accident, if it's a weather balloon, or even crash test dummy tests in the air at the time, those official documents haven't surfaced either. So that's a case of other documents, if they did exist, they're gone, or they didn't exist in the first place. So my view is I think it can go one of two ways, either some sort of weird and dark and disturbing military experiment, or a genuine crash of a UFO, whether extraterrestrial or interdimensional or whatever they are, you know. But again, I think the big problem is the older and older the case gets, you know, the more and more sort of difficult it becomes to resolve it. And I mean, you know, sometimes people do think, well, it's not that long ago, until they realize it is practically 70 years ago. I mean, you think about it, a guy who was, say, 23 at the base at the time of the Roswell event would be 90 now. You know, when you look at it like that, that's how long ago that event was. And
human nature, the way it is, Nick, when you get somebody in their 90s, rightly or wrongly, a lot of people even question if the guy knows what he's talking about by that time. Now, that's an easy way to die, I think, you know. In other words, if somebody knows something, well, we say, well, look, that guy's 90-some-odd. What do you think?
Yeah. But I think somewhere, you know, if aliens did crash at Roswell, then clearly there must be massive things like autopsy reports on the bodies. There must be reports and photographs of the crash site and the wreckage that was found and studies of the wreckage if they were able to, you know, understand it in some fashion. So clearly somebody has to have this material evidence somewhere. But again, you know, it's like with the Freedom of Information Act. You can use the Freedom of Information Act to file requests with government agencies for documents. But if you don't even know the name of the agency because it officially doesn't exist, then that makes it even more of a stumbling block in trying to get hold of the files, you know. Not that I think they'll probably be released in the first place, but if you don't even know which door to go knocking on, that makes it even more difficult.
Yeah, you got a good point there. And time, of course, is no ally, as you mentioned a little earlier. The book is for nobody's eyes only. And how'd you come up with that title? I like that title.
Well, actually, that was what the publisher came up with. I didn't. I sometimes have problems with titles, and sometimes I'll spring to mind straight away. And that's sort of a... you know, back and forth with the publisher over different ideas, and they said, well, what about For Nobody's Eyes Only? I thought, well, yeah, that's a good one. So the publisher can take the credit.
And now this book is available pretty much everywhere, right?
Yes, it's available through Amazon, through Barnes & Noble's website, or it's also available on the shelves in Barnes & Noble if you've got a local store as well.
Mm-hmm. That's good. You've written a heck of a lot of books. How many books? Can you even keep track these days? I mean, you've written a lot.
I've done around about 30, of which about half of those are UFO books, and half of them my other big interest, which is cryptozoology, which is like strange creatures like Bigfoot and the Loch Ness Monster. So I've kind of split the books between the two, basically.
Yeah, you've done some interesting books on cryptozoology and other things like that, and we've talked to you about that in the past.
Yes.
And there's sometimes... And you alluded to earlier in this conversation that there might be some sort of interdimensional connection. In other words, we might be dealing with creatures from another time or another place or something.
Yeah, I mean, there's absolutely no doubt in my mind there's a genuine UFO phenomenon of unknown origins. I mean, the sheer number of reports that we've got over the years, you know, back to the 40s and 50s, where people report, pilots even were reporting encounters with things that were far in advance of anything we were flying. And when you put that together with things like alien abduction reports and contact stories, we're clearly dealing with a genuine phenomenon. But I'm not wholly convinced it's necessarily extraterrestrial. I think a sort of an equally good case could be made that it's interdimensional, something that kind of coexists and flits in and out of our reality. Sounds more plausible to me than beings coming from, you know, however many star systems away or, you know, galaxies away. And particularly, you know, when you look at the reports of these entities, they very, very rarely are reported wearing sort of space helmets or spacesuits. They seem to have the ability to operate very easily and comfortably on our planet. And in abductions, you know, they take human DNA and eggs, sperm and cells, etc., for these supposedly genetic-related experiments, and they're exactly compatible with us and vice versa. Now, that kind of all sounds a bit incredible to me if they are literally from the other side of the galaxy. But if they coexist with us in some sort of dimensional range here on Earth, so to speak, it would make more sense that they would be able to operate in the Earth's atmosphere, you know, with oxygen levels and gravity levels, etc. And it would also possibly explain their ability to be able to utilize our DNA and cells, etc., if they kind of are related to us and coexist with us in some fashion. So I certainly don't rule out the extraterrestrial theory, and maybe somehow the two are interconnected, but I think the interdimensional one is sort of an interesting angle to follow up on.
Well, Ed, I guess the secret to being a good reporter, a good writer, a good investigator, and you're all of those, in my opinion, is the fact to keep an open mind, not rule out anything.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I do think that's an important factor, Jerry, is to not get caught up in belief systems. You know, I mean, I do believe there's a genuine UFO phenomenon, but I try not to get caught up in beliefs as to whether it's time travelers, whether it's aliens, whether it's interdimensional creatures. I think what I can say for sure is that there's a genuine, an absolutely genuine unknown intelligence and phenomenon from somewhere else dealing with us and interacting with us. And it's nothing to do with us. It's nothing, you know, the government's doing, or it's not faked alien abduction reports using mind control by the government. It's nothing like that. We are being visited by something. But I don't feel any sort of need to sort of fly the flag that it's extraterrestrial any more than I need to fly a flag that it's interdimensional. I kind of feel that if we find the answers, great. We'll have the answers and we'll know. And if we don't, we theorize, but we make sure people realize it's a theory rather than hard facts until we have the hard facts, you know.
Yeah, Nick, when we talked about so many of these possibilities that may happen and everything. I want to get back to something we talked about a little earlier in the program. That's something you found out in your research, and that evidently is that a lot of people don't know where any of these files are, and only a few, if any, know. And how do you think we got into that kind of situation? Where was it just so much of a closely held secret that when the people passed away, they just let it die with them and take it to the grave?
Well, I think certainly a lot of the witnesses from Roswell, you know, they went to the grave. Although a lot of people did come forward, retired military people who worked at the base at the time, a lot of them did come forward. You know, I think a good case can be made that a lot of people who were really in the know did take those stories to their graves. Now, certainly the information itself would not have just gone to the grave, because that would have been inherited by whoever took over their position in that secret group. So in that sense, you know, it is a case.
Well, I'm just saying, maybe they put it someplace on purpose that would be hard to find, and nobody would think to look there. Maybe it's filed under a different title or something.
Yeah, I think as far as people in government are concerned, I think a lot of people have legitimately looked for these files, like when the General Accounting Office went looking. You know, that wasn't a cover story or a half-hearted investigation. They really, you know, pushed on every door, but they didn't find anything. And I think you make a good point there that, you know, files could be hidden under other names. They could have been siphoned off years ago, and, you know, nobody knows where to go looking for them. Clearly, this material is not held in, like, the National Archives or some, you know, visible presidential archive or something like that. It would have to be more kind of like a highly classified archive, which only a very small people have access to. You know, kind of like the whole issue with the sort of the classic imagery in the Raiders of the Lost Ark movie, the Indiana Jones movie at the end, where you find that the Ark of the Covenant is not being on public display or even being shared with mainstream archaeologists. It's actually sort of locked away in this secure military warehouse, if you like. And I can kind of see that happening with Roswell, that the fear that if they got the mainstream scientific community involved, the secret would leak out. So I sometimes wonder if they don't really know what to do with the Roswell wreckage of the bodies other than store them away and occasionally bring in a few scientists who they trust to look at it and say, but, you know, you cannot tell anybody ever. And I think the big problem is that most scientists, you know, they have big egos. They would want to be the person who tells the world, I've seen the aliens. And I think whoever's hiding the truth knows that, and they realize it's a problem. And that's why they can't bring the best minds in to study it, because they fear that the best minds will then go running and, you know, get a book deal or whatever and be the person who proves that aliens exist. So it's a problem. It's a problem for all of them, I think.
Yeah, Nick Redfern is our guest, and his book is For Nobody's Eyes Only, and it's a unique title and a unique read. It covers a whole lot of things. We started out talking about Roswell, but let's switch gears and go to some other topics. You know, something we were talking about here earlier, Roswell is so far back, not quite as far back, but still pretty far back in time, was the JFK assassination. And evidently, you have written in that book and talked to a couple of people about JFK files, and they're still not available. I mean, even after all these years.
Yeah, a lot of people assume today that all the files on the assassination or related to people who were involved in it are in the public domain. Actually not. What happened was that, excuse me, when Oliver Stone's movie JFK came out in 1991, there was a big push on the part of both the media, the general public, and even people in government to finally put all the material in the public domain. I mean, this was done for sort of two reasons. One, to try and sort of lay to rest the conspiracy theories. That was one of the hopes of people at an official level, that, you know, if we put it all out there, we can't be accused of hiding anything. And the other theory was, the other idea was just to share all the information so the general public and the research community would have the ability to sort of study all this material and just see where it leads, you know, see what it what turns up. And so since then, since the Act was put into place, there have been literally a couple of million pages of surface, which sounds a lot, but a lot of it is sort of very bureaucratic material, and there's certainly no smoking guns within all this particular documentation. Now, one of the big problems, and again something that many people aren't even aware of in the slightest, is that not only are a number of files still withheld, there's roughly about 1,000 CIA files withheld, and we don't know how lengthy each of those files are. You know, if each file was 500 pages long, and you're talking about 1,000 files, when you still see then it's a lot of material. But one of the other problems is that we can actually prove many potentially crucial documents on the Kennedy assassination were actually destroyed decades ago. I mean, I talk about a number of these in the book, but one classic and perfect example is Lee Harvey Oswald's Army intelligence file. Now, while I do personally believe there was a conspiracy at the heart of the Kennedy assassination, I don't think that Oswald was just an innocent patsy as he portrayed himself. I think he was set up to be the lone gunman, but I think he was involved and he knew he was there to act, play a particular role, but I don't think he obviously realized he was going to be set up to be the fall guy. Now, what's interesting is that back in 1973, Oswald's Army intelligence file was actually destroyed, and the circumstances under which it was destroyed are actually still questionable to this day as to on whose authority it was undertaken, who actually destroyed the file, and under what circumstances it was destroyed. Now,
have you got any answers on that?
What happened was that in the 70s, the House Senate Committee on Assassinations, which looked at reopened the Kennedy assassination case and came to a completely different conclusion to the Warren Commission, the HSCA concluded there was a conspiracy, and they actually petitioned for Oswald's Army intelligence file. And the Army got back to them and said that, well, sorry, we're not able to send you the file because it was destroyed in 1973. And as I said, the circumstances and who gave the order, that's still very much a grey area. Now, of course, we'll never really know what was in that file today, but I think it's safe to say that an Army intelligence file on Lee Harvey Oswald, who, you know, had links with the military, who had links with a lot of shadowy characters in New Orleans, who went to Russia and came back, surely that Army intelligence file would have contained a lot of crucial information that would have shed more light on his activities and his character and what he may have been up to. So that's one of the big problems. It's not so much just trying to get hold of the files that are still classified. It's having to deal with the fact that really significant files from years ago were destroyed years ago. We'll never know today, what was contained in that material. It's just, for all intents and purposes, that piece of history has been wiped out.
You haven't even been able to figure out or get even a clue as to who actually ordered the destruction of these files?
No, the response that the House Committee, the Senate Committee on Assassinations got was that when the military went looking, they could not find the paperwork that showed who actually gave the order and who actually carried out the destruction and how the files were destroyed or where they were even destroyed. All of these issues are either grey issues or conflicting issues. It's never been sort of satisfactorily resolved at an official level.
Who or what group or whatever could put together an obfuscation program like this just to muddy the water and nobody can find anything? I mean, you can't even find out who was responsible for getting rid of the files.
No,
do you have an idea?
No, unfortunately, we have no idea. What's kind of sort of eerily weird is that that's exactly the same with the Roswell files from 47 that are missing. It's not just that the files are missing, but almost identically as with the Lee Harvey Oswald file, that whoever gave the order for the destruction or the removal of the Roswell files, that hasn't been shown or proved either. That's again, something else. Where the files are gone, but we don't know who gave the order or whether they were destroyed or pulled. You know, that's a big problem.
We were talking with a fellow who I have the most high regards for as a reporter, writer, author, reality-based, John Rothreich. Well, I guess we could say it's reality-based, even though you deal with paranormal and other things as well. Nick Redfern, and his new book is Not for Anyone's Eyes, or I think I screwed up the title that time. I don't know how I could. Did I get it right, Nick?
For nobody's eyes, Ollie, that's, yeah.
Okay, you're right. Okay. So busy bragging on you, I lost where I was. Now, tell me a little bit more, if you can, about something that jumped out at you this time around when you looked at the JFK files. And the whole story. I mean, you've visited it many times, I know, haven't you?
So you broke up a bit then. Have I looked into the files, did you say?
Yeah. So you just don't know, there was nothing that really jumped out from you on your research or anything you read by anybody else. I think it gives you an idea. I mean, the thing I always thought was mysterious is the autopsy pictures being burned at the fireplace. Is that story true? Have you heard about that from the Bethesda Naval Hospital?
Oh yeah, never mind the sort of the documents, the photo angle as well, you know, and missing photographs allegedly and altered and doctored photographs. That's an interesting angle. I want to talk about in the book, for example, where there was supposedly like a military intelligence presence at Dealey Plaza on the day before the assassination, taking photographs, and those pictures have never surfaced at all either. So, like the documents, a lot of the pictures that should exist, they've gone as well.
Do you think that these are different groups operating and keeping things secret, or are they all part of one big group? Of course, we don't have any yet.
Actually, that's a very good question, because I think it actually is several different competing groups. And I kind of find that not just with the JFK assassination, but also particularly with the UFO mystery as well. That's to say, I think when we look at the people who've spoken about the UFO subject at an official level or the Kennedy assassination, it's almost like there are competing factions where some of the people on the inside want the story to come out and others don't. You know, I think there's often a tendency for those of us on the outside to think that there's always this sort of unified belief or, you know, sort of situation where everybody on the inside is of one mindset. You know, this is what we're going to do. This is what we're going to keep hidden. This is what we're going to tell people. And in fact, I don't think it is like that at all. I think there are people, particularly with the UFO subject, on the inside who really want the information to come out, but, you know, they have no way for it to surface. You know, we're not able to get it sort of through the Freedom of Information Act, so this makes it very difficult. But, yeah, I think we're sort of dealing with sort of conflicting factions and groups in the same way that, you know, in the UFO community we don't agree on everything. I think that's exactly the same on the inside as well. And I think probably they don't always share information with each other. Again, you know, you think that if one group has something on Roswell, they might be sharing it with another sort of deeply buried UFO-based group. But if that other group sort of got a different agenda, they may be out of the loop, you know. And people don't often realize that agencies in governments all around the world, not, you know, just in this country or that country, hide information not just from the public or the media, but from competing agencies as well. You know, that's how it works.
It's true. You, in this book, also cover some other subjects that I'd like to kind of go over with you. One of those things is evidently there's some missing information or data on the Watergate files. Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, Watergate is, you know, one of these, I suppose, one of the ultimate sort of 1970s era conspiracies, you know, the whole issue of President Nixon, bugging the White House and, you know, spying on the Democrats and so on. And you know, it was a major scandal that essentially led to the downfall and resignation of President Kennedy, President Nixon. And so certainly without doubt, you know, one of the major events in sort of 20th century American history. But yeah, we're sort of lacking various materials as it relates to Watergate. And certainly one of the most interesting ones I talk about in the book was sort of an 18-minute or so telephone conversation that had been recorded between President Nixon and someone who many people believe was one of the people linked to the White House / Watergate conspiracy. And this particular recording has become infamous because nobody doubts the recording existed, but it was allegedly mistakenly recorded over by Nixon's secretary.
Well, Rosemary Woods took the blame for that, the secretary.
Yeah, that's right. She felt she was almost like the fall guy or the fall girl, so to speak.
Yeah.
And the story was that she was sat at her desk and a call came in and she leaned over in one direction to record the call and then inadvertently with her other hand deleted the conversation, the original conversation. But when the official world sort of dug into it, when they were looking into the Watergate saga, they found to actually achieve that, to tape the one call and listen to the conversation, delete the other all at the same time, you know, you'd have to be almost like an acrobat to stretch across the room in the fashion that she said she did. So this seems to have been like the official conclusion was that it had been wiped. There's no doubt it had been wiped. And there was a great deal of suspicion on those part of those that looked into it that it had been wiped deliberately to avoid implicating Nixon. And that was the conclusion of not just certain players who were writing about and researching the Watergate saga, but people who are actually involved in the official investigation. You know, they simply did not buy the story that Nixon's secretary was telling. And yet, to her credit, you know, she stood by it to her dying day. She said, no, that's what happened, and that's the way it played out. And what's interesting, though, is that a committee was actually created to study that recording, and they tried with the technology that was around at that time to see if they could actually clean it up somehow and sort of remaster the original recording, but it was gone. You know, there was just no chance, unfortunately.
A lot of things missing that I would love to know, and I'm sure most people would love to know. It makes you wonder what's being hidden from us today. Evidently, it's still about the same volume of secrets, in my opinion, that we've always had. I mean, it seems like we've been a secret society in many ways.
Well, yeah, I think that's one of the important things. Yeah, I mean, there's no doubt that, you know, I mean, history as we know it certainly isn't the full story. I mean, you know, when we talk about Roswell being sort of almost 70 years ago, you know, the closest British equivalent, if you like, of Roswell was the famous Rendlesham Forest case of December 1980. Now, December 1980, you know, not that long ago. It's only 34 years ago, and a lot of the guys involved were only sort of 19, 20, 21 back then. So those guys are, you know, for the most part, if not completely, all still around. They're mainly sort of early 50s now, or maybe mid-50s at the most. And many of the official papers relative to the Rendlesham story have gone. One story that I talk about in the book that I think most people won't know anything about is that the Rendlesham event itself occurred over the 26th to the 28th of December 1980. And within the Rendlesham research field, there have been a lot of rumors over the years that at the height of the encounters, three prisons in the near vicinity of the forest were primed for evacuation because of some event involving national security, like a national emergency. And given the close proximity of the prisons to the base and to the forest and the time frame and everything else, this is sort of the assumption is that the planned evacuation of the prisons was somehow linked to the UFO event in ways we don't necessarily understand fully. Now, one of these prisons was called High Point Prison. And about 10 or 12 years ago, Lord Hill Norton, who was a former high-ranking member of the British Ministry of Defence and actually a former chief of the defence staff, he got interested in Rendlesham. And he got very interested in this story about the supposed prison evacuations. And he actually tried to get hold of the governor's logbook for December 1980, the High Point Prison, to see if it contained anything relative to the UFO events and this story of an evacuation. And so he asked that the logbook be declassified so he could see it. And the government of the day got back to him and said, well, we're not able to give you or show you the governor's logbook because it's disappeared. And, you know, all the other logbooks for 1979, for all the rest of 1980, for 81, 82, they were all there. But the logbook for December 1980 was gone. And just like Roswell, just like with JFK, nobody could figure out who had gone in and removed the logbook, where it was, had it been destroyed, had somebody stole it. It was as much a mystery, you know, as the case itself, almost.
Yeah. It seems to me that there have been entirely too many missing things, like what we've talked about recently. And nobody seems to know why they were missing, how they got there, who would be responsible for it. In other words, there never really seems to be a public investigation by anyone with some authority. Now, maybe there are some exceptions to that, but most of the time it just seems like it's passed over and people hope it'll go away, but it does go away.
Yeah, and
so I think it's one of the good things that you do is bringing up these things and looking at them from a new angle and looking at it. Go ahead. I didn't mean to interrupt you.
No, that's fine. No, what I was just going to add was, you know, when you look at all these stories about files going missing from the U.S. military in relation to Roswell and documents vanishing in relation to the Rendlesham Forest case, my personal view is that we're not just looking at like a secret agency in the U.S. that oversees Roswell. I think we could be looking at an entire, like an international agency or an international sort of secret elite group of people, you know, that have strands in maybe in pretty much every country, you know, and unbeknownst to the elected leaders, they exist in every country. And their job is, you know, they have regular jobs, but they also get recruited into these off-the-record organizations or this worldwide organization, kind of like the equivalent of, you know, a very old sort of powerful order or body that existed but still does, you know, and their agenda is to keep the wraps on it, but they do so by infiltrating the official world. So again, you know, there may be an infiltration of the British Ministry of Defense in the same way there may be an infiltration of the Pentagon. In other words, it's not the Pentagon, it was not the Ministry of Defense that's doing this. It's somebody in their midst, if you like, that is working against them even, you know, to keep all this hidden. And I think when you see, as I point out in the book as well, files have vanished from Australia on UFOs, from the UK, from Canada, from the US, you begin to see a pattern where it's clearly not coincidence. And there seems to be very powerful people who are able to oversee all this and, you know, just grab this material when they want it.
So if ETs or extraterrestrial UFOs, or even interdimensional, I guess, there is, to me, apparently, at least some circumstantial evidence that they're working in tandem with not just one government, but several. How do you feel about that? You think I'm on the right track here?
Yeah. In terms of several, you mean?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I don't doubt that at all. I think, you know, the whole issue itself is sort of made up of numerous components. You know, whether it's the types of creatures that are coming here, the places they're coming from, the agendas, the official involvement with different groups organizing things and planning things or manipulating things. You know, the word several applies to just about every aspect of the phenomenon, whether what it wants with us or how we deal with it or who's hiding it. You know, the whole thing isn't just, it's just one agency hiding things and it's just one group coming in, it's from one place. No, it's all far more complex than that.
We're talking with Nick Redburn, and next hour, our guest will be Mary Sutherland, and she's going to talk about her new book, which is all about the red-haired giants who have disappeared. And so, Nick, you've done a lot of research of weird beings and things like that. What's I guess most of it gets traced back to cryptozoology, but is there anything that jumps out at you or over the years you've gone on this subject? Because you've investigated a lot of things from ghosts to strange creatures in the night.
Well, yeah, I mean, I try. There's a lot of things I'm interested in, but there's also a lot of things I'm not that interested in. You know, ghosts and hauntings don't really interest me that much, but cryptozoology does and UFOs do. And one of the interesting things I've sort of found over the years is there are a number of cases where certain aspects of cryptozoology and ufology cross paths. That's to say, there are some cases where people have seen UFOs at the same time frame and same place where Bigfoot-type creatures have been seen. A friend of mine named Stan Gordon wrote a very good book called Silent Invasion, which dealt with a wave of Bigfoot / UFO activity in Pennsylvania in 73, where you had reports of like these large, hairy, giant creatures having been seen at the same time in woods and forests where these strange lights were seen flitting through the woods. And the creatures reportedly were vanishing in like a flash of light or just fading away or just, you know, suddenly winking out of existence as if they were kind of like interdimensional. And, of course, when you bring UFOs and Bigfoot into the same angle, so to speak, it creates a lot of controversy. And a lot of the UFO people don't like to admit to touch the Bigfoot stuff. And a lot of Bigfoot people try to keep the UFO subject out. But for me, you know, if that's what the witnesses said, you've got to follow up what they say, because the witnesses are the most important people in the subject. Without them, you know, we've got nothing. So I find that kind of fascinating, you know, that some of these crypto creatures could actually be somehow linked with the UFO phenomenon as well.
Yeah, and Stan Gordon has some interesting stories about things that happened up in Pennsylvania involving strange beings that suddenly just disappear or look like they're, I mean, it goes on and on. We're going to have Stan on again here pretty soon. So you were with him recently, huh?
Yeah, I've done a lot of research sort of just recently into, you know, this sort of ongoing research. I mean, I'm always getting sort of stories. In fact, Stan himself sent me one today, sort of a new roundup of all his UFO and Bigfoot stuff. That was kind of ironic that came through this morning. So, you know, I think one of the problems is, you know, when we go back to when you said about belief systems and UFOs earlier, it's the same thing that kind of affects the cryptozoology community, that so many people think, you know, Bigfoot is just an unknown ape, the Loch Ness monsters are plesiosaurs, and so on, you know, and a lot of people, you know, they simply will not touch this weirder aspect, but, you know, the weirder stories exist, so we really, the responsibility is on us to look into them. And that's like what Stan does. You know, Stan, I think to his credit, came to realize that Bigfoot is weirder than just an unknown ape. It's not just a North American equivalent of like an African gorilla. There's something strange about it. You know, and people disagree with Stan, but he stood on his own ground, you know, on his own feet and said, nope, this is what's going on, and put out a book about it. And it was a good one as well.
We're I'm out of time with Nick Redfern, and we always appreciate you coming on, Nick. You have any closing comments or want to talk about something that we've left out that you cover in the book, or give us a little hint about what you're working on now?
Well, I mean, I just say that, you know, even from my own perspective, I've not really sort of delved into the issue of missing files before. You know, even I was kind of amazed at the sheer number of files that, not just that they've gone missing, but that they've gone missing so easily. And even under the eyes of, like, the archivists, whose job it was to preserve them. You know, even the archivists couldn't figure out how the material had sort of leaked or been, you know, pulled and destroyed or shredded or basically stolen and taken to, you know, the heart of some unacknowledged agency or whatever. And when you find it happening all around the world, as I note in the book, then that's why I said I think it's outside the loop of elected government. I really do think there's, you know, people talk about sort of the Illuminati and groups like that. I actually think the whole UFO thing and these strands and tentacles operating all around the world, I think it's kind of linked to something like that, like an ancient order that has inherited the UFO phenomenon, and they're the ones who, you know, have the control. And everybody's knocking on the door of the Pentagon or the CIA or the Air Force and saying, you're the bad guys, release all the files. And the Air Force are saying, well, we don't actually have them. And they really are telling the truth. You know, they're not lying, I don't believe. But again, the problem is to identify them. But, you know, if at least we can show the files have gone, then that may give us sort of some inroad as to where we go next to try and find them, you know.
Well, Nick Redfern, thanks for being on tonight. And the name of the book is For Nobody's Eyes Only. And it's available just about everywhere.
Well, thanks for having me on the show, Jerry. Thank you a lot.
Appreciate it very much. Now, on March 3rd, our guest will be Jim Mars. March 10th will be Paula Harris. And I think you'll... you'll enjoy both of those interviews. In fact, I know you will. And Jim's subject, he's got a new book out about it with lots of evidence on the elites, the super rich, the blue bloods of the world, and how they've made communion with extraterrestrial people or beings or whatever you want to call them, forces, I guess would be the best term. And these extraterrestrial forces are working in conjunction with the powers that be on Earth, and it's not for the common good of human beings at all. So I think this is a show you won't want to miss at all. And if you got the emails, any comments or anything like that, feel free to write us at jerry@jerrypippin.com. And we'd love to hear from you. We try to answer all of them.